Radio Free Hyboria, this is Herman the Hyborian with my pal Billy the Barbarian, ready for another episode. Specifically, this is episode 5, of course, of Radio Free Hyboria. Billy, how are you doing, man? Have you been slaying a lot of, have you been doing a lot of slaying? Not just slaying the ladies, but, you know.
Yeah, no, I'm a lover, not a fighter, so I don't even have a sword.
You're Michael Jackson. No, I'm kidding, I'm kidding. Okay, that's cool, dude. You know, whatever, you know, floats your boat. I respect that. I respect your policy of non-violence. You know, I'm the same.
Yeah.
I'm coward, but I love the violence on the comic book page. And that's what we're going to give you listeners here on our Patreon. And this is our 5th episode, like I said, of RFH, Radio Free Hyboria. All right, so Billy, this time we've got 2 great issues. Specifically, Conan the Barbarian number 5, and then, of course, Cole the Conqueror number 5, and 2 great covers as well, but, you know, I gravitate more towards the Cole cover. We'll discuss them later. The Conan cover is getting better, you know, but I still maintain my position that Barry Windsor-Smith is not really a great cover artist, or at this point in his career, he wasn't. It just looks a little bit too generic, I think. And maybe editorial also dictated what the cover should look like because they were, it seemed, you know, if you read interviews with Roy and so forth about this era of Conan, that Stan Lee still had a hand, you know, and of course other guys like Archie Goodman as well, but Stan Lee had a hand in quickly looking over covers and you know, giving his input, and then they sort of have to follow what he said. For instance, what we mentioned in previous episodes about, you know, there's too many animals on the covers. I don't like that, said Stan. You know, so... But Billy, when did you first encounter specifically the Conan issue? And we can also talk about the Cull issue. Was it early on in your collecting career, or was it more recently that you acquired these issues?
No, it was very recently. I hadn't read very many of these early Conan issues until I got the Epic Collection a few months ago. The lowest numbered Conans I had read was, I think, volume 3 of the Dark Horse reprints, those trades. So that was like maybe 15 or something at the lowest number. I don't know. It's nowhere near number 5. Like, it might be 15 or 20 or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, that was it. It was same here. You know, I never read these in issue form. I don't own the issues myself. But I think I read this Conan tale, and most of the Conan tales, I'd say at least the first 20 issues of Conan, I read in the now, you know, mythic Marvel Essentials Conan the Barbarian number 1, you know, even before Dark Horse acquired the rights to Conan in the 1990s, Marvel put out a Marvel Essentials with Conan, which I managed to pick up, and I still own it, although it looks horrible now. The pages are all yellow, and you know, I tried to keep it free from mildew, couldn't here in Taiwan, which is a very humid country, you know, but I keep it in a bag. But, you know, I read the black and white, you know, Conan, the first 20 issues or so, and I remember particularly loving this specific tale. You know, if you read everything in bulk, right, Billy, sometimes it just goes into into your brain and then leaves your brain as soon as you get to the next issue, right? But this issue made me think and go back and ponder and wonder. And also, obviously, the character that we're going to be discussing, Zukala the Sorcerer, he will turn up again in Conan the Barbarian, specifically in the Elric issue later on. And then he will turn up in somewhere in the 200s as well. When Roy returns to the title briefly, I think around 249, somewhere around there. But Zukala is sort of a recurring villain for Conan. If you think about it, most of his villains are one-off villains. You know, they die pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Except for maybe the Tothamon. But Tothamon is more in King Conan, you know, the sorcerer from Stygia. He's not really... Yeah, you can't really... He's sort of like always... he's a villain, you know, in the Robert E. Howard books, definitely, even though he only shows up once in the Robert E. Howard short stories, I should say, from Weird Tales.
Yeah.
But Conan's villains, basically, they all perish, you know, fairly quickly. He kills them, or they die by their own hand, or, you know, by some form of twisted irony. So, you know, he doesn't have any recurring villains. But this Zukala guy turned up 3 times. So that would make him a recurring villain, in my mind, at least.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, man, I love it. So I'm going to give some specs, and there's a lot of info I have about this particular issue, which I'll impart after we discuss the story. But first, let's get to the details about the issue, and then we launch into our synopses. All right, Conan the Barbarian, number 5, cover art by Barry Windsor-Smith. And this issue was cover dated May 1971, but on sale February the 23rd of 1971. 32-page count, cover price 15 cents, edited by Stan Lee. Okay, the title is Zucala's Daughter, and then writer Roy Thomas, penciled by Barry Windsor-Smith, inked by Frank Giacoya, and lettered by Sam Rosen. Now, normally Sal Buscema inked these early issues, right, Billy? But this time around, they got Frank Giacoya, who's known as a Kirby inker. He's also known as a great inker from, you know, the Silver Age of Marvel. But he's not really, I don't think he gels particularly well with Barry Windsor-Smith's pencils. I don't know about you.
Yeah, not really.
But of course, you can find this issue reprinted. It was reprinted several times before trade paperbacks came along. Giant Size Conan number 2 from 1974 had this issue in it. Conan Saga from 1978, that's number 2, had it. And then Conan Classics from 1994, number 5. And then, of course, the way I read it was the Essential Conan Volume 1. But right now I'm reading it in my Dark Horse trade paperback collections, which is still Volume 1. And, of course, Billy, you're probably reading it in the Marvel Epic Collection. Not that you would call it an Epic Collection anymore. Just a very thick-ass trade paperback.
Oh, yeah. Love them. Yeah. They're good money. They're good value.
Yeah, I love the way they feel. I don't have the Conans, but I have some of the, you know, the Luke Cage, Powerman, Iron Fist ones and so forth. They feel great. So well done on Marvel doing that. I wish DC would get on the bandwagon and start doing that. They do to an extent, but not, you know, in the volume that Marvel does. And it makes collecting fun again to get all these old issues that would have cost you, you know, an arm and a leg to get on eBay.
Oh, gosh.
Damn.
Yeah, crazy.
So, Billy, I'm going to let you go first with your synopsis for Conan number 5. What do you have for us there?
Once again, Conan finds himself wrapped up in a mystery as he's on his way to Shadazar the Wicked. He's at a small village that is being terrorized by a ruthless wizard and a pet tiger. Or is it?
Right. Now, that's on the money, man, because that's basically what happens. A pet tigress, you know, like the cover says, right? The claws of the tigress.
Yeah, cover kind of gives us away.
Yeah, now it's funny that you mention he's on the way to Shadazar the Wicked. As our listeners might remember, the previous episode we did, it was the Tower of the Elephant. He was already in Shadazar the Wicked. And this means that these issues were published out of order, the way they were written. Now, Roy did that, you know, and he says at the time he thought it was to drive sales because he wanted to publish the stronger tales first. You know, so Barry Smith, he had already done The Grim Grey God, which is issue 2. Mm-hmm. And then he had already penciled The Tower of the Elephant and Zucala's Daughter. But The Tower of the Elephant was supposed to be issue 5. And Zucala's Daughter was supposed to be issue 2. But then, you know, Roy moved The Grim Grey God up because he thought it was a stronger story. And then Tower of the Elephant was moved up as well to, you know, published earlier to drive sales. So Zucala's Daughter is a little bit, if you look at it from the perspective of Conan leaving the northern lands of Hyperborea, which he was in issue 1 and a bit of issue 2. Now he's drifting down towards the southern lands. Now, this is out of chronological order then, right, Billy? Because he's not in Shadazar the Wicked yet. He hasn't encountered Yara and the Tower of the Elephant. But, you know, I don't mind, because the Robert E. Howard Weird Tales stories were published out of chronological order in terms of, you know, Conan's age and his life and, you know, his experiences, his various, you know, professions, a reaver, a slayer, you know, a thief, all of that. A buccaneer. So, you know, I don't mind. When it comes to Conan, they can publish him out of order any which way they want. Because it's a standalone story, it wraps up neatly. All right, so my synopsis goes as follows. Conan enters a Zamorian border town and meets the local tax collector, Zephra, a human tigress, and the shape-shifting daughter of Zucala, a local wizard in the Iron Mask. hired by the town to off the father and daughter duo. Chaos descends as Zukala and his demon Jagtanoga is opposed by Conan and a newly infatuated Zephra. We'll see Zephra get the hots for Conan and turn on her dad. So, interesting. But Lina, what did you think about this issue as a whole? I already said I unabashedly love it. 5 out of 5 for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like it quite a bit. You know, like I said, you know, we kind of both alluded to it. The artwork isn't really up to where it has been for the first 4 issues. And I mean, the only thing different is Chiyokoya inks instead of Sal Buscema. So I guess, you know, that's the road we're going to go down there. Just, you know, say it's, you know, a different inker. He just really wasn't good at maybe for Barry Windsor Smith. But the story, love it. The artwork, it's still good, but it's just not up to the level it has been. But yeah, I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I mean, you still got the classic Conan look that Barry Windsor Smith cemented in these early days. He's got the helmet with the horned helmet, and he's got a more lean look to him, muscular though, mm-hmm. and a foot or so taller than most of the Samorians he encounters. That's to be expected. So he's a giant in stature, and I love the opening. You know, he arrives in the Samorian village at dusk. And then as night descends, and we see as he walks through the village, everybody ogles him because he's obviously a foreigner, yeah. He's a barbarian, and this one, alluring little lady carrying this water vase or something, this water jug, she's only got eyes for Conan.
Yeah, she looks like she's looking at his backside, I think.
Yeah, checking out his butt or something. As it sways beneath the cloak. And then there's even like a scowling bald guy in the background looking like he's a cut purse or something, waiting to catch Conan off guard. You've got a dog with his tongue lolling out of his mouth, even looking up at Conan. So even this dog is unused to foreigners entering the town. And then Conan, he sees a blacksmith because, of course, Conan's interested in weaponry. Blacksmith tries to sell him this sword. But Conan doesn't have enough money, and then suddenly the entire town just goes dark, right, Billy? It's a magical type of darkness, too. I mean, even though it was dusk, night was descending, it just abruptly became dark. So there's some supernatural shenanigans here, we know that. And then, Billy, what does Conan see?
Yeah, out of like this, it almost like appears out of this Kirby crackle here. Out of the sky, a tiger. A real crazy looking tiger jumps out of this, you know, it almost looks like an apparition at first, but then becomes solid and just, I like how the one panel just goes over to this like cart full of like antiquities and just with one swipe of its paws, wham, and smashes this cart to bits.
Yeah, this tiger is, you know, nobody to mess with because very dangerous. Obviously a supernatural tiger as well. We'll find out why just now. You know, it's funny. There's a funny scene on page 2 where this blacksmith, he grabs his head in his hands as darkness descends, and he says, "Oh, no, I forgot. And Conan grabs and says, "What did you forget, man?" And the blacksmith says, "I forgot to pay my taxes." Essentially, right? I'm paraphrasing here, but that's what he says. Tax collectors come.
This is really no different than modern day America, and the tiger is the IRS. This is kind of how it works. You don't pay, exactly. They come get you.
Oh man, it's great. And then this tiger appears out of this fiery type of magical effect after appearing in the sky in the Kirby Crackle, and like you said, starts smashing up carts and food stands and menaces these two. And, you know, listen to Conan here, man. He really lets his libido do all the thinking, right? As these two folks, which is this mom and this child, or it could be an older sister and her younger brother, we don't know. But as they're menaced by this tiger, Conan says, "There's two who didn't run fast enough. And one of them is a pretty package to boot." She's about to be eaten by the tiger. So what? He's going to save her because she's beautiful? That's basically the reason he gives.
Yeah, and it's then, like there's a woman and a child there, man. Come on.
Yeah. Now listen to Conan, his strategy, because he's afraid he can't get to them in time. So his strategy is to insult this tiger first. He says, "You lizard chaser, old eater of frogs. Here's cold steel for you, if you've a taste for it." Oh my crazy. Goodness. Oh, but it works because this tiger attacks.
It does.
Yeah. But what does Conan soon realize, Billy? I mean, he killed the lion in the, and he in fact references that. So, you know, this makes it even doubly weird because he references that he had a run-in with the lions in the courtyard of the, you know, Tower of the Elephant with Yara.
Right.
And yet now he's approaching Shadazar the Wicked. You know, so this is something that I think was put in after the fact. You know, editorial, Stanley might have noticed that, or Roy put it in himself, even though it was the issues were penciled out of chronological context. Roy put some dialogue in here that made it seem more chronological, if you know what I mean, Billy. I mean, he's on his way to Shadazar the Wicked, and yet he just referenced that he fought lions, you know, in Shadazar the Wicked, you know, a little while before. So, you know, a little bit of a faux pas there by, you know, Marvel as a whole. Still, how do we know that this is a supernatural beast, Billy?
We'll be back after a quick break.
Ever wish you could sip cocktails and discuss great books with your friends while hanging out in a rundown piano bar? Here on the Literary Guys podcast, that's what we do. I'm Dr. Gordon McCallan.
And I'm author Zachary Kellyan. Each month, we discuss books from two different views of modern masculinity.
From both a gay
and a straight perspective.
From To Kill a Mockingbird
to future governors in the jungle trying to kill a predator. We welcome everyone to join our conversation on the good and toxic of what literature and pop culture have to say about masculinity. So pour yourself a drink and join us now for Season 3.
Literary Guys. That's G-U-I-S-E. LiteraryGuys.com.
I see what you did there.
Well, it's funny. He takes a swipe at it with his sword, and the sword just shatters when it hits it.
Yeah.
And that's when he's just like, oh, crap, something's going on here. And then it bites him and looks like it's ready to, like, kill him. But then all of a sudden it doesn't. And then he kind of gets some, like, almost telepathic conversation going on with Tony the Tiger here.
Talkie Tony.
Yeah.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Now, you see, this is the thing, Billy. This tiger, as we know from the front cover already, we're not spoiling anything until we get to it. I'm just going to lay it out for you, listeners. This tiger is this lovely lady that we see on the cover, Zephra, that we referenced in the synopsis. And she seems to have fallen for Conan while she was chewing on his bicep. Right, Billy? Think about it. She was chewing on his muscular arm there, and she's like, okay, this is tasty. And then she stared into his eyes just before she ripped out his throat, and then she fell in love with old Conan. And then she decided, nope, she's not going to kill him. She's going to rather retreat to the forest and, you know, I don't know, daydream of him instead. So the villagers are surprised. You know, at first I think Conan's in league with the beast, or, you know, with whoever's taxing them, and they want to string him up. But then they say, okay, maybe this foreigner, he's tough enough to take on Zephra the tigress, so maybe he can also take out her dad, Zukala, who's the tax master. You know, the guy who taxes us incessantly, and if we don't pay up, he sends his demons or his daughter to destroy the town. So they want to hire Conan for 40 gold pieces to go and kill Zukala and his daughter. And, you know, Conan's up for it because, after all, it's money, right? But, you know, he also says that this is now a little bit personal. So what, his pride has been hurt because the tiger had the better of him, right?
Right.
So he says even without the money, he'll do it. But he'll still take the money. Mm-hmm. Plus, he wants the sword. The blacksmith.
Yeah. That's the funny part. Yeah, he's like, I want that sword. The villager's like, all right, we'll get it for you.
Yeah, but we see that these villagers are scum because right after Conan leaves, they decide that, if he does succeed and he comes back to the village, they'll, you know, cut his throat in any case and so avoid paying for his services. But then, you know, we see this bit in the forest where Zephra transforms back into her human self. And she is a pretty package, as Conan would describe her, I'm sure. And, you know, she has this Kirby look to her face a little bit. You know, this is still Barry Windsor-Smith firmly in. But now it's even more so with Frank Giacoya inking, you know, who's used to inking Kirby. But a very pretty Kirby, you know, face. Like, I think Kirby drew pretty women, you know, most of the time. So, you know, I'm not counting Granny Goodness here. Of course not.
Gross.
Yeah. So, you know, then Conan decides he's going to do it, right, Billy? But what happens to Zephra when she approaches her castle where she stays with her dad, Zukala, the sorcerer?
Yeah, she passes out. And it's funny. I don't know what he's up to because he has a bird in his hand. Like, he's killing it.
Yeah, for no apparent reason.
Mm. I don't know what he's doing, this maniac. He's, like, squeezing the crap out of this poor bird. And she comes over and then just collapses. Like, she just passes out in his arms.
Yeah,
well, and then we switch back to Conan and the villagers again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, I love that scene, though. And I think Roy also referenced in interviews that that's one of his favorite Barry Windsor-Smith scenes because he didn't put that in the script. Roy didn't. You know, Barry Smith just penciled it like that. You know, so technically the script was just Zukala arrives and tells her dad of the villagers' unwillingness to pay and the fact that she encountered this barbarian, and then the dad gets upset and then he crushes this pet falcon that he was holding. But, you know, the way it's drawn is in the first panel when we see him holding the bird on his hand, it looks like a falcon or something, or a hawk. But in the next panel, it looks like a pigeon, you know, when he crushes it to death in anger. Yeah. Oh, but that's a horrific scene, you know, this animal murder here. But I love the fact that right at the point where he crushes it to death, he says, "The ungrateful swine!" Referring to the villagers who refuse to pay. Grateful for what? I mean, he doesn't do anything for the village. They just basically extort money from them, right? Pay up or we kill you. So why should they be grateful? Yeah.
Well, not only that, and then he has this creepy line here, too. After he says the ungrateful swine, he looks at his own daughter, which, come on, man. And he says, "But why so pale, my pet, like some thin-blooded mortal?" I'm like, gross.
Yeah, call her daughter that. Come on, man. In a weird sexual way. Yeah, but and it seems that he is, you know, connected to her in this weird, you know, I don't know. It's definitely got some amorous intentions towards his daughter, which is very sick there, because he gets very upset when she chooses Conan over him, and it's more than just the daughter's loyalty to her father that upsets him there, you know. So you're right, he's got this creepy vibe to him, and he's also wearing this iron mask, or this metal mask, which makes me think of the man in the iron mask. But he refers to her as more than human, right? But he says, like, why are you so pale, like a thin-blooded mortal? So it turns out, in fact, these two are immortal. They were old when Atlantis was young, you know, so even before King Kull's age, the Thurian age, they existed, you know, and then they witnessed the fall of Atlantis, the fall of Acheron or Acheron. I don't know how you pronounce that ancient city, but it came after Atlantis, a city of power, Acheron.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they're still around. So they're immortal, they're semi-human. And now they've got it in for the villagers. And we see that Zukala has more than enough sorcerous means to take out the village even without the help of his tigress daughter, right, Billy? But Conan, he stalks through the forest, approaches the castle, and he climbs a tree and leaps over the parapets. And then, you know, he enters and he sees Zukala performing this weird ritual. Now, while Zukala is performing this this magical spell or whatever, he's summoning forth a demon. I like the effect where he's got these two apertures in the top of his mask, which covers his entire face, by the way, this metal mask, kind of Iron Man-esque looking, right? And then while he's, you know, effecting his sorcery, these tendrils of fire or smoke, or it's yellow in effect, I think,
Electricity or something? Yeah, you can't tell what it is.
Maybe electrical power. Yeah, it looks like it's crackling. You're right, Billy. It exudes from these two apertures in his face mask. Wow. So that's a pretty cool effect.
So, Billy, it's super cool.
Who does he summon here, this demon?
Yeah, he opens this portal to another dimension or something like that and pulls this demon. And he says, "Come thus in my name at my call, the call of Zukala." And then you see this crazy-looking creature. I don't even know how to describe it. It's probably like 7 or 8 feet tall. It's got horns like a devil, some red hair, like a mullet almost. It's green skin. Looks like it's all tatted up. And then his legs, I mean, it looks kind of hairy on his legs, like almost like the Heap. Like some kind of, it's hard to tell if it's hair or
it looks
or
a little bit like Hellboy,
what.
Billy, like Hellboy, you know, from Mike Mignola.
A little bit.
Less bulky, but infinitely taller, And it's even got some kind of a costume on, or is that just tattoos on its body or something that makes it look like it's got like a costume? But it's all red.
Yeah, I always thought it looked like it's had tats on, and then over the its dong or whatever, it's got like this moss or something there covering the, because you know they didn't want to put swimming trunks on them, so I guess they felt they'd do that to placate the code.
Yeah, that's right. And Jaktanoga, this demon that we learned that's his name, he's actually an old Kull enemy from one of Howard's tales of Kull, The Curse of the Golden Skull. So that's where... And Zucala, too, we should mention. The wizard Zucala is from a Robert E. Howard poem, which we learned in the beginning, the very first page. I've got some more info on that later when we finish discussing the story. But yeah, Zucala's hour is the hour, just before... dusk, when children are born with strange powers, gifted to them by this wizard Zucala. That's what the poem of Howard was about, Zucala's hour. And then, of course, Roy just appropriated the name and turned it into Zucala's daughter, to bring this girl into the mix. Kind of like a Dracula's daughter type of, inspiration there.
Yeah.
And also, they took some inspiration from the Nathaniel Hawthorne story, Rappaccini's daughter, a famous... Okay. Nathaniel Hawthorne story, because Roy, we know that he was an English teacher, right? He taught literature, until he was 24, and then he moved to New York, obviously, to pursue his comic writing career. So you see all of these literary influences coming into Roy's work. So believe now, this Jaktanoga, this guy, he seems to be possessed of all kinds of powers, because he flies out of the window towards the village, and we never got to see quite what he did to the village. It appears as if he did nothing, because he was summoned back, but I thought he would have devastated this village, because basically Zucala sends him to destroy it and says, the peasant's gold means little to me. So he did in fact bring the gold back, right? But we didn't see if he devastated anything. And then Zucala says, the gold means little, but it reminds the fools just who is master and who is slave.
I love that part. Yeah, we don't know if that guy just rampaged through the village killing everybody and taking their gold, or if they were just, he scared the piss out of them, so they threw their gold out the window and ran. You know what I mean? You don't know what happened, but either way, it's cool.
Exactly. It's damn cool. It's kind of better that they leave it up to our imaginations, to fill in these gaps. I kind of like that. Mm-hmm. And then Billy...
I hope he killed everybody.
Oh, me too, because those guys were bastards.
Yeah, they're idiots.
Except for the pretty package and her ward. But, kill the rest. And then,
just leave the women and children. And then if they want to repopulate, Conan can swing by and help out with that.
That's right. The women, the children, and the dog. Yeah, Conan can easily help repopulate that village.
yeah, no problem there.
He's a stud. Anyway, and then the girl, Zephra. She finds Conan hidden behind some tapestries, right? Or drapes there. Mm-hmm. And then...
Spying,
him. Yeah. She grabs him, and then she snuck up on him, and he was surprised at that. And then before she can talk, he closes her mouth for her, and he says, weren't you the woman who turned into a wild beast? And then, she says, is it hard to believe, Conan? And then she suddenly just ups and, smooches him. And she says, you're destined to be my lover, right? But she's seen the future with her magical powers. And she's seen Conan standing over her body with an axe in his hands. So she's crying as she's kissing him, but she wants to make the most of this time. And then Conan, he returns the kiss, right? He was ready to get on right then and there. But what happens then, Billy? He gets cock-blocked.
By her father, of course. He comes busting in. And crumbs, devils, do doors mean nothing in this place? And it's like, Conan, it's his castle, you idiot. He can go busting in any door he wants, especially if you're making out with his daughter.
Exactly, and he does so in a magical way, too. Like, he seems to be able to travel around as a wisp of smoke or a string of electricity. Like
an apparition.
Yeah. And then he can solidify. So he's definitely, more than human. And then he tries to blast Conan with this... lightning bolt or electrical effect, and Conan dodges, and then Conan proves more than a match for this sorcerer. He just takes his sword and hits him in the face with it. It slashes him. I wouldn't call it slash. It looks like he used it as a club, right, Billy?
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if this guy didn't have this crazy mystical magical helmet on, It almost looks like he might have chopped the guy's head right in half. But yeah. Since that guy has that on, it kind of saved his bacon there.
Yeah, but he damaged the mask, and the mask seems to be what is providing him with his magical power.
Yeah, the daughter, I think, says as much at some point.
Yeah, so since the mask's been damaged, his power has been halved. But Conan chases him through the castle with Zephyr in hand, and then they enter the throne room, and he still has magical power. He changes Conan's sword into a viper or a snake,
and then Conan
hurls it into a brazier. And there's the word brazier again. And then Zucala tries to blast him with a firebolt. Now that Conan doesn't have a sword anymore, he grabs these two axes off the wall. And
that's so cool.
Yeah, that's cool. But they're on very thin hilts, right, Billy? Thin handles and thin sticks of wood that support these giant heavy metal blades. But it works because, again, Conan, you know, proves the better of Zucala here. He smashes the brazier, almost decapitates Zucala a second time, and he's about to deliver the coup de grace when suddenly, you know, he resorts to his daughter. What does he say, Zucala, there?
He commands her to attack him and rend the fool limb from limb. And she's like, almost like, I can't refuse. And of course, Conan's there, and he's like, the tigress. So he sees her change into a tiger, which is crazy. And if you look on that one page there, when she first starts turning into the tiger, her mouth is full of Kirby crackle.
Yeah, so you're
it's
right.
It's crazy. It's like, it's insane. What the heck? the tigress doesn't know what to do. And then, you know, of course, Zucala's like, well, if you won't do what I tell you, then here comes my other minion, this, like I said, whatever, half devil, half yeti, it looks like almost or something. Is it hooved?
Red, like, hooved
yeti. What the heck
yeti.
Is it? Coming in through the window, like, I'm going to kill everybody. He's, like we said, he's got those gold coins from the villagers, and it's awesome. He's going to go to town on Conan.
And then Zephyr jumps into the fray. She wants to defend her new love here, Conan, and she assaults this demon. And it seems that she's able to hold her own against this giant demon, even though he's much stronger than she is, because she's supernaturally tough as well, right, Billy? She kind of reminds me in the way that Barry Windsor Smith and Frank Giacoya draw her, is sort of like that Omega Men character, Tigor. You know, when he changes into his tiger form, it's this giant, badass, supernatural-looking tiger. She's very similar to Tigor, and she attacks this demon. She holds her own for quite a while, and then Conan grabs Zucala, and you know, he says, "Are you willing to destroy your own daughter just to kill me?" And then Zucala just says, "All who oppose me must die." He doesn't really care about the life of his daughter, which is hell.
What a jerk! Yeah.
Conan picks him up one-handed and body slams him to the ground. And but he leaves him lying there and then grabs the axe because he must save the girl. So, Billy, what happens then? Conan enters the battle.
Oh, my gosh. This is great. He smashes that beast demon thing right up against the head with the axe. And it does kind of hurt him a good bit, but he's still with it enough that he clobbers the poor tiger, you know, Zephyr, and smashes her into like a table and a wall. And the tiger, you know, she reverts back to her female form, and she's laying there looking pretty hot, by the way, I must add.
She's
and very luring. And then it's Conan against this creature, and it's pretty apparent very quickly that he's not going to be able to stop this creature. But then, you know, Zucala wakes up, and he's like, he thinks he's going to take everybody out, and he's like, we're just going to get out of here because I don't want to, what does he say? One day he'll return, and he says, but you shall understand when we meet another time, and on that day you shall face the full power of Zucala, and you shall tremble before you die. And the poor chick's like, Conan, Conan, and he grabs her, and they disappear. It's crazy.
Yeah, that's it. Basically, I mean, he banishes the demon, and like you say, Conan's ready to take Zucala on, but then they teleport away. The girl, like, you know, pining for Conan there. She's injured. But, you know, her father's, even though he says that now, you know, he wants revenge against Conan because Conan forever ruined his relationship with his daughter.
Yeah, now, which is weird.
Yeah, it's very weird. Now, we know they will return, specifically like I referenced earlier in that Elric issue, right, Billy? But, you know, Conan then, he does get his payment, because after all, the demon left that sack of gold coins lying around. So Conan doesn't even bother to go back to the village to collect his payment. He just like picks up the sack of gold coins and then heads off to the next adventure to Shadazar the Wicked. And then, you know, that's the end of the story. But like I say, we'll see these characters again. Unfortunately, the next time Zephra appears, it will be the last we see of her, but her father will, like I say, be a mainstay if you count him among Conan's villains. But a great issue, Billy. Very action-packed, art-wise, not as high as, you know, the standards we've been used to, but still not bad. I've got some extra,
it's so good.
Yeah, some extra info here about the issue. As we mentioned, you know, Roy, he got permission from Glenn Ford. Glenn Ford. Oh my goodness. Am I thinking, wasn't Glenn Ford the actor who played Superman's dad in Superman the movie? Wasn't that Glenn Ford? Isn't he an actor?
He's an
actor, yeah. Anyway,
dead.
I meant Glenn Lord. Yeah, he's dead, yeah. Glenn Lord, damn it. The estate agent for the Howard, you know, estate. The estate, you know, he helps run the Howard estate, and he allowed permission for Roy not to only use short stories from Robert E. Howard as material for Conan comic book tales, but also poems published by Robert E. Howard, right, Billy? So we've seen that in The Grim Grey God, where Roy already did that, and now we've got them here in Zucala's Daughter. And like I say, the poem that he based this off of was one by Robert E. Howard called Zucala's Hour. And, you know, Roy, it had nothing to do with the poem. Basically, the poem is about a sorceress character who sort he's like a legend, and he gifts people with certain abilities. You know, every time his hour comes around, which is like between sunset and, you know, and midnight, somewhere in between there. And then, you know, that's what the poem is about. But Robert E. Howard wrote two other poems about Zucala as well. Zucala's Jest. And I think the last one was called, if I'm not mistaken, now I've forgotten that, the last one. It must be here in my notes somewhere. But anyway, he wrote three poems about Zucala. And it's very similar to the character that Roy, you know, gave us on this page. You know, it's like this sorcerer who's above the affairs of humans. In fact, he uses his magic as a jest to mock the gods and also to show how fragile humanity is, which is interesting. And then, we've even got some of the poetry in the first bit of the Conan story, right, Billy? We've got a few lines, you know, that I think just four or so lines that Robert E. Howard quotes there. In the very beginning, and then you know, you've got these two ladies in the inn who serve Conan when they tell him the story, and that's also taken roughly from the poem. You know, the one lady that serves him soup or broth or something when they're about to hire him to go and assassinate Zucala, the girl says, "It said they're ageless; time can never touch them." And the old woman says, "'Tis true, for once I beheld the girl dancing neath the stars when she was young and I was young. Now she is still young while I grow old and withered." You know, and then she says, "Where's the fairness in that? Death to them, says I. Death to them both." You know, so he took some of this. And then when Conan approaches the castle, these are more direct lines from the poem, not just inspired by the poem, but taken from the poem. "High in his dim, ghost-haunted tower, Zucala sits alone, like a spider spinning his webs of power upon his moon-pale throne." Right, Billy? That's pretty. That's powerful writing there by Robert E. Howard that Roy decided to appropriate there. But, you know, this poetry was published in 1970 by the Howard Estate at the behest of Glenn Lord, and it was in a volume called Singers in the Shadows. And that's where Roy read it. And then he approached Glenn Lord to say, "Hey, man, some of these poems are very evocative. Can I use them?" And Glenn Lord says, "Go right ahead. Be my guest." Because the Conan comic was bringing a lot of attention back to Robert E. Howard, you know, so they were happy for this kind of free advertising.
Well, yeah, and you figure he was bringing in some money, too. They, you know, for every story or issue or whatever, what were they getting, $150 or $200 or something like that? So that's pretty good money.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah, no, it's good money for them. And still, I mean, it's grown since the 1960s and 70s, the estate of Robert E. Howard, you know, because Conan's so popular, even more popular than he used to be of late. And I'd say he'd maintained a level of popularity that's just slowly been growing, you know, the more people know about him. Yeah, and it's not just because of the movie from the two movies from the 1980s. It's also because of, you know, just the wide, the constant reprints, you know, of the Conan Weird Tales stories. And also, you know, of the people who've been writing Conan fiction other than Howard, you know. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot out. Mm-hmm. You know, so Billy, then a little bit more about this issue. Originally, Jack Tanoga, the demon, killed Zephra in the comic, and Barry Windsor Smith, the daughter, he drew all of that. But then for some reason Roy decided he would like to keep her around, and they would like to see her again in a different tale. So he already had the Alric story gestating in his brain, and that's why he asked Barry Windsor Smith to redraw those pages where you know, she's in fact where she survives. And you know, then we have Zucala and his daughter Zephra slated to show up again. And Roy seems to have liked Zucala particularly, because when he stopped, you know, writing the Conan the Barbarian, you know, he returned like 10 years later or so, or not 10 years later, 8 or so years later, to write Conan again briefly.
Yeah.
And then the very first villain he introduced again after he restarted his stint on Conan was Zucala.
Mm.
Yeah, so Roy had a real feeling for this character. So we'll see them again.
He's pretty cool.
Yeah, man, he's pretty cool. We'll see them again in Conan the Barbarian issues 14 and 15. And then, like I mentioned, the one that Roy came back to write many years later was issue 241. And you know, that's... Mm-hmm. Oh, but there, I should mention, Zucala also showed up in a black and white story in A Savage Sword of Conan. But that was out of context. Yeah, so a great character, a great issue, and I love it when Roy gets his inspiration from, you know, literary sources. Like, you know, he said he also was inspired a little by reading William Butler Yeats, you know, W.B. Yeats, the Irish poet, when he wrote sections of this story. So yeah, great going on, Roy, here.
Cool.
Now, Billy, we'll head right into Cull the Conqueror. Can you give us the details on Cull the Conqueror number 5, which is also great?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, this is Cull number 5 from November 1972. And this one, a little change up here. This one's written by Jerry Conway.
Yeah.
But then we still have the awesome team of Murray and John Severin on the interiors with the artwork. And then Sam Rosen letters. And I'm assuming, it doesn't say color credits, but I'm assuming that's Murray, because she did a lot of colors too. So
yeah,
I'm assuming she did that too. And then, of course, you know, Roy Thomas, editor. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so everything's very cohesive. They keep it, even though Conway's there, we knew he worked closely with Roy, and Conway's a good writer, great writer. So this story really worked for me, Billy. I don't know what you felt about the overall plot and so, but again, it's a rippingly good yarn featuring Cull. I loved it. Lots of adventure. Very dense, if you compare it to the Conan comic. It took me longer to read this one, to reread it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but worth it. You know, I love the art, and of course the writing. It all works for me. So you know, Billy, what do you have for your? Oh, I should go first for the synopsis, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. Go ahead. Yeah.
Okay, I have it as the island of Damascar wars against the Isle of Rikos, and Cull is caught in the middle, bribed by the riches of Prince Hanar. Cull and the Black Legion set sail to battle zombies, flying demons, and treachery as they are offered up as a blood sacrifice to fuel the spells of Damascar's sorceress priest M'Ku. Will Atlantean Thews prevail against foul sorcery? Stick around and find out. That's it. It's it's actually more dense than that, even. You know, the plot is
oh, very
is
much, yeah.
Very thick. So what about you, Billy? What do you have for your summary there?
All right. So after a hunting trip with his partner in crime, Brule, Cull is asked for help by another ruler from a neighboring land. He agrees to help, but soon regrets it, as some of his men are torn to pieces by dozens of flying killer reptiles.
That's right. Yeah, man. That's exactly right. Now, I read this story, I wouldn't say recently, but, you know... I picked up the King Cull, the Chronicles of Cull, the five Dark Horse volumes that they put out about 10 or 12 years ago. I can't remember. And that's the first time I ever read these stories, you know, Billy. Like, I read a sporadic couple of Cull issues in my youth, but I could never find the entire set, you know. And you've recently picked up, like we mentioned before, all the Cull comics that was published by Marvel in those early years. But me, I'm more of a research... even though I read the old King Cull tales in the... probably in the 1990s or so, when I managed to get a collection of that. You know, I've never read a lot of Cull comics, so this is fairly recent for me. But, you know, I loved it so much that I've reread it dozens of times in the intervening years. So when did you first read this particular tale?
I think, if I remember correctly, 4 and 5, the last two we've done here now on our Patreon, those were a couple of the last ones for me. Like, I think I even had 1, 2, and 3 before I had 4 and 5. For some reason, I don't know if there just weren't too many sellers trying to sell these or what, but these took quite a while for me to get. So, but I love the name of this one, A Kingdom by the Sea. You know, when you open that first splash page there, it's great with Cull hunting with this giant longbow and shooting an arrow. It's great.
Yeah, he shoots a deer, and at the very same time, a crossbow bolt hits the deer from the opposite end. And then Cull meets this gigantic Nubian prince, Hanar. He's a dark-skinned prince from what would be Africa in the Thurian Age, I'm sure, or an island close to Africa. And then he and Cull are about to come to blows because Cull... he accuses him of being a poacher because these are Volusian lands. And then the Prince Hanar of this kingdom of Damascar, he hurls this dagger and then impales a wild boar who was charging Cull from behind. And then so saves Cull's life and then endears himself to Cull. So that's a pretty interesting page, right, Billy? I kind of like it. And Cull admires his crossbow weapon and his accoutrements and his accoutrement, I should say. And then it seems that he's accompanied by this entourage of soldiers. So this guy's regal. And he then pays tribute to Cull with these treasure chests and these fine vases and pieces of art.
Weapons and stuff.
Yeah, and then Cull's... you know, people in Volusia, they're very greedy. We'll see that later on as well. Even the Picts, like old Kanu and Brule, they're also very greedy when it comes to gold and treasure. Cull doesn't care one way or another. He just wants it to help the people, of course, of Volusia. But Cull's not really in it for the riches anymore. He's not a plunderer like Conan. He used to be.
No, he's got some great lines here. Trinkets, goldsmith. What use are toys to a king? And then the one goon says, but such toys, sire, weapons struck of a metal, ne'er seen in all Volusia. And then some pothead and more priceless herbs.
Pothead, yeah. A ransom of spices. Oh, man, that's great. That's really great. Yeah, these folks are trying to sway Cull to say, listen, we need to establish diplomatic ties with this country, this Isle of Damascar, because these folks are... rich AF, and they'll make us even richer. So because of that, Cull sees the wisdom in, you know, keeping his people happy. And, you know, because, of course, there's dissent among the people that a barbarian is ruling. Cull wants Volusia to prosper. So, of course, he's going to reach out towards Prince Hanar. But it seems that the prince is interested in more than trade. He wants Cull, essentially wants to hire Cull's Black Legion as a mercenary army to fight off the enemy Isle of Rikos, who's been plaguing Damascar for ages. And he says that, you know, if the Black Legion consents to come and help them free themselves from Rikos, then he will make it worth their while with untold riches. And now you can see three panels after he makes that pronouncement. Three panels of Cull's closest advisors and friends and Black Legion commanders with these insane and evil expressions of greed on their faces. Billy, do you want to see? And then, you know, old Kanu the Pict, he says, Cull, with this evil grimace on his face, Cull, he speaks well. Kanu likes this prince of Damascar. And then Cull just dismisses him by saying, your greed is legend, Pict.
But I agree. Yeah, and I mean... that's something that you don't see in Conan. So there's all, you know, some people think Conan and Color are very similar, but if you really read the stories over time, they're really not, because Cole, you know, he's a king here right from the get-go, and then there's always this subplot where, like you kind of referenced earlier, that the land he is ruling is not, you know, a land of barbarians, but they kind of, there are some people in this city that, you know, don't like it that he's ruling, so they're constantly plotting against him.
Yeah, and then that informs his decision, you know, when he has to pick out the crew for his flagship, mm-hmm. along with the rest of the Black Legion. He picks these traitors that he knows are plotting yeah. against him to come with him so that he can, I mean, what do they say? Keep your friends close, but your enemies closer, right, Billy? That's what Cole's doing here.
Yeah, and the best is when he says about, I designate Baron Kanub and his friendless companions. And that Baron guy has his hand over his mouth. Yeah, he's like, oh no.
I don't want to go.
It's great because he's a coward.
Exactly, man. Exactly. And he's got this little dwarf plotting with him. And then, you know, they head across the sea. Mm-hmm. But it seems that, you know, there's some shamanic magic involved mm-hmm. with these folks of Damascar, because on the voyage right across the ocean, they pass Atlantis, Cole's native land, and then they go around the Thurian continent, and it seems that on the very southern edge of the continent there is a strait, and across that ocean strait there are these two twin islands, and that is the mm-hmm. Those are the islands of Damascar and Rikos. And before mm-hmm. they get there, though, there's a storm coming. And it's a pretty hefty storm by the looks of it. It could be hard going for the ships. So this shaman, Mku, who works mm-hmm. for Prince Anar, he says, okay, I can effect some rituals to banish the storm, but we'll need a sacrifice. But he whispers this in Hanar's ear. And then one of the sailors is about to climb up the rigging, right, Billy? And then Mku touches his shoulder or scratches him with some kind of... device
like a needle,
with a needle, and that affects mm-hmm. his nervous system because it creates a sense of euphoria or drugs him. We don't know exactly what happens, but once he's up on the mast, he suddenly goes stiff as a board and mm-hmm. he plummets to his death.
And that is so terrible.
Yeah, that is the sacrifice needed to power this blood magic that Mku Jeez. Has and banishes the storm. Yeah.
That's awful.
That's awful, man. And then, you know, Cole says accidents are an ill omen at the start of a campaign. And then Brühl says, if an accident it were. You know, so mm-hmm. they're suspicious already. But then, you know, they mm-hmm. come to this beautiful port city of Damascar. Mm-hmm. And this place is amazing. It almost looks like some kind of Arabian influence there, right, Billy? Architecture-wise.
Yeah, Middle Eastern, I was going to say, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, they meet these ladies and, you know, the Baron and some of the people with Cole, they say, I'm a lord. With women such as these, all judgment fails. So they're greedy and horny.
Yeah, there's two very attractive looking women in the forefront here, and that little jerk is, you know, slobbering over them.
Yeah. And as soon as they've arrived, though, they're attacked by these flying demons sent by the Isle of Rikos. And, you know, they just, like, start ripping into the Black Legion and the people of Hanar. And then Baron Kanub makes a run for it, right?
And he just takes off and runs.
Redondo laughs at him. He sneers. He says, you know, Redondo the minstrel, also mm-hmm. one of the traitors, he says, afraid Baron, is this proper behavior for one who lusts after the topaz throne? And then... You know, Baron Kanub just says, I'm no fool, Redondo. When I claim the throne, I'll need a head to wear the crown.
And then in the very next panel, there's one of those winged demon lizard things, and its claw is grabbing this guy's entire head.
Crushing
its grasp. Yeah. It's crazy. Yeah. It's
freaking cool. And then, you know, Cole slashes into this demon's neck and goes for a bit of a flight up into the air. He kills this mm-hmm. demon, which is half bird, half dragon, right, Billy? Or half turkey.
Yeah, it looks like
turkey.
it almost looks like a lizard-type dragon
yeah.
with these huge bat wings, but then the face like has like a beak, like you said, yeah, like almost like a bird.
Yeah, it's mm-hmm. it's very cool the way Marie and John Severin drew this. I love it. I love the mm-hmm. design of this monster. It's very leathery-looking, very you can feel the organic texture just by looking at it, right?
Oh, yeah, it's excellent.
Oh, it's beautiful. And then, you know, there's a real sense of motion when these things fight, because you see them sinuously sort of twining through the group of Black Legionnaires as they you know, slaughter them. And then when they take off into the air as well, you can see this real sense of momentum to it. You know, that's just great penciling. And then Cole kills it, and he swims to safety. And then he's praised as a hero. The demons have been vanquished. But, you know, Cole's now suspicious, because he says, "You didn't say anything about sorcery, Hanar." Because possibly half of the Black Legion's already been taken out. So then, you know, but they resolve to stay, because now Cole wants revenge for the dead Black Legionnaires, right? So he's going to still, he's going to stay for the money and for the treasure, but he wants revenge on the Isle of Rikos. But he's approached by this this lady who's sort of a seer, and she has a crystal ball for him. And she shows him in the crystal ball the history of their people. Now, what do we learn here, Billy?
Well, she says, "The people of Rikos are demons, good king. Countless eons ago, our two lands were one, but cosmic catastrophe tore us apart. And where in one land light did reign, in Rikos was darkness which became supreme." And you see this crazy-looking dude doing, like, you know, some kind of magics, and all these people bowing down to him like he's a god. And then this next panel, man, is that creepy. You see this person, it almost looks to me like it's a kid laying on this altar, and this maniac dude with this skull helmet and an axe, like he's going to kill him. And it says about death and human sacrifice.
Yeah, and then all the people from Rikos were eventually sacrificed for their blood magic, until they all became sort of zombie-like demons, right, Billy? The Walking Dead, really?
Yeah.
And they're the only ones now still alive on the Isle of Rikos, and yet they still want more flesh for their blood magic, so they keep abducting or attacking or raiding the Isle of Damascar for living victims. And that's when Zakhar, the sorcerer who initiated this black magic from Rikos, turned on everyone, really. And then, you know, one country was still prosperous but plagued by this evil Damascar, while, you know, Rikos is just like a hellhole now. And then we see Cole just dismissing this lady, right? He says, "What do you want me to do, witch?" And she says, "Whatever your heart tells you to do, my lord." And he just says, "Leave me, girl." And then and he wants to consult Brühl, you know. They want to have a man-to-man chat here to discuss their plans. And he sends Brühl on a spying mission. And meanwhile, you know, talking about traitors here, the four traitors, you know, scum here from Volusia, you know, they're drafting up a secret parchment to send to Hanar, saying that they would love it if Hanar would ensure the death of Cull. And then, of course, Hanar would be richly rewarded by these barons, because they want to get rid of Cull. And then what does Hanar do, Billy?
Well, it's funny. Like I said, those four guys are like, "Yeah, we're going to, you know, draft this thing up." And then we see the Maku checking it out, and he says they want them eliminated, and a hint at a future reward. And it said, "Our hands must do the deeds," and he says it must be answered. And they all kind of open it up, and it says, "With a reminder of the traitor's own reward, a subtle jest, but certainly an amusing one." They all open up this parchment of paper, and it shows a hangman's noose on it.
That's the answer to traitors. Oh, you know, Hanar doesn't care about them. Well, Hanar doesn't care about any of them, because they're all slated for the chopping block, as we learn soon, right, Billy? This has all been a trick, because Brühl is spying on Hanar and Mku as they, you know, go over their plans. And he learns that they've basically hired the entire Volusian army, the Black Legion, to die on the open seas in battle against zombies for blood magic, so that the death of the Black Legionnaires will fuel their power, and then they can effect even more magics to ensure the survival of their people. And then, you know, Brühl's presence is detected by this cat, who seems to be the magical familiar of Mku. And then Mku seems to be an incredibly accomplished sorcerer, right, Billy? He wears this golden eye patch, but he lifts the eye patch, and he's got this magically red glowing jewel for an eye underneath the eye patch, which summons these disembodied hands, super super strong in their own right, who just attack Brühl and drag him into the window, and they hold him down. These hands.
Yeah, there's probably like a dozen of them at least.
Yeah, so he's captured, Brule's captured, and then the next morning they report, Hanar and his soldiers report to Kull that in the night Brule was taken by flying demons, obviously lying to mm-hmm. him. And now Kull's even more incensed. Now he wants the battle to commence even faster, so he just gets the legionnaires ready, and they set sail across the ocean to Rikos. And then they're confronted by this fleet of zombies. Also, the zombies still seem to be, I mean, they can still sail ships, they're intelligent, you know, they're undead, but they still retain, you know, all their human skills. And then while this is happening, M'Ku has, in his secret hideout, he's got Brule tied up, you know, hanging, you know, upside down from the ceiling, ready to be sacrificed, to be made a part of this blood sacrifice, because he's got this giant pentagram that he drew on the floor, right, Billy? And this is the spell needed to absorb the power generated by the death of the Black Legionnaires on the high seas to fuel his magic. Mm-hmm. And Brule's still conscious, but he's left alive to bear witness, right? So Kull and the Black Legionnaires are already engaging the zombies in battle, and it's going quite badly there for them. Because, you know, it's tough, right, Billy, these undead legionnaires that they're fighting. And then while this is happening, though, you know, there's some problems in the city of Damascus as well, because their idols are being destroyed by, you know, the power of the spell that M'Ku is initiating. And then Kull confronts Hanar in a lull during the battle, and then Hanar says... Kull asks him, why aren't you fighting? Where are your men? Why are only my Black Legionnaires engaging the fleet? And then Hanar tells him the truth. He says, well, you were meant to die so that we could fuel our magical power. Now, why don't you die too, King? And then Hanar engages Kull in a battle. And it seems to be that he's his equal, right, Billy? Because, for at least for a little while.
Yeah,
but while all this is happening, Brule, man, this guy's cool. Brule is like some kind of a barbarian James Bond or something, because what does he do, Billy, or barbarian Batman here?
Well, he starts swinging back and forth, you know, using his weight and on this rope, and he gets close enough and grabs that M'Ku by the neck and then swings him and throws him, like, right into the crazy... Is that like a fire in the middle of the?
Yeah, there's like some magical fire that's the power being generated by the blood, you know, spell. It's become this conflagration in the center of the pentagram, and Brule hurls M'Ku right into the center of this fire, killing him, disrupting the spell, and then also simultaneously burning his bond so that he can free himself. And he runs away from this devastation that he's caused. So while the city of Damascus is burning down, Kull gets the better of Hanar on the ship, because all of the zombie soldiers are turning to dust, and that distracts Hanar, and then Kull just severs his right arm. He just chops it off. He lops it off.
Mm-hmm.
Hanar is defeated, and then Damascus is crumbling, right? It's being destroyed, but the women of Damascus are kind of, you know, they're compassionate. They want the treasures of Damascus to survive. So when Kull hits back to shore, the women draft him to, well, basically... take their treasures to safety. And when he says, what treasures? What do they show him, Billy? What are they talking about when they refer to treasure?
Well, there's like, I don't know, what, 1, 2, 3, 4, like a couple of dozen children.
Yeah.
You know, that are just, you know, haven't been touched by any kind of curse of sorcery. Yeah. So, you know, Kull's a good dude. So he's just like, you know, hey, I guess we'll take them aboard. And it's kind of a shame because then, you know, everybody else dies. But, Kull is funny because when she starts reaching out to him, he's like, doesn't lying tire you, witch? And she's like, no, dude, I'm not lying. Look. And like I said, she shows this panel all these poor little kids, you know. So kind of a interesting angle if you think about it these days with, you know, how some countries or areas of the world are in trouble. And, you know, they're looking to have some children get out of there and taking people on and stuff like that. Kind of interesting.
Giving them asylum, Kull does that, you know, he makes the right decision. But first he asks Canoob's advice. And Baron Canoob just says, we don't have room for foreigners in Volusia, these barbarian scum. And then Kull says, you've made my decision clear. Thank you, Canoob. Take them aboard. So whatever advice Canoob gives him, Cole will do the opposite because he knows this guy is a reprehensible piece of crap. Yeah. And then, you know, they take them across, and it finishes with the Thurian Chronicles speaking about the destruction of the islands of Demarcus and Rikos, because now both of them are crumbling because of this rampant magic that's been unleashed by M'Ku. So they ended up killing each other in the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So,
fantastic issue, Billy. Now, I don't have a lot of details about this issue because John and Marie Severin never did a lot of interviews about how they came up with the stories for Cull, nor did Jerry Jerry Conway. I couldn't find an interview with him. But I think it was inspired by, you know, obviously they came up with the story themselves, you know, Jerry. Mm-hmm. And also Roy helped with the plotting a little bit, probably, you know, since he was editing. But a great tale. I love it. Intrigue, there's treachery, there's betrayal, there is a lot of action. And then, of course, there's this crazy sorcery. And I'm going to pick Brule as the MVP of this issue. Man, he really proved his worth here.
Yeah, he's awesome. I love that character.
Love him, too. The Spear Slayer. Mm. Yeah, one of Cull's... well, he's kind of like the Robin to Cull's Batman, or possibly more than that, you know?
I feel like they're equals, you know? And they do treat each other that way, you know? They don't... You know, sometimes it'll be a little bit like Cull will be like, oh, hey, Brule, can you go do this or go do that? But it's not like he's ordering him to do like a subservient.
No.
They're like best friends, really, want to do well.
Yeah, even Cole's a my friend, you know, most of the time. Mm-hmm. Now, Brule, it does have the sort of hero worship for Cull, but, you know, they're definitely, you know, best bros, and Cull treats Brule as an equal, even though Brule might not see him as an equal anymore. He might see Cull as his king. So, you know, or something more than a king, you know, almost like a religious figure at times. But Cull has warranted that reputation, right? Because he is, you know, larger than life. So, you know, Billy, another good Cull issue here, though I'm going to have to pick as my personal favorite the Conan issue, Zucala's Daughter. I don't know what it is about it. I just loved it that, you know, Roy bases off of a poem by Howard. And then, you know, he had this weird subplot of, Zephra falling in love with Conan and turning on her dad, and this demon Jagdanoga, which seemed like sort of like a red herring introduced there. But, you know, it worked for me. It's all good, and I love it. Art-wise, too, it worked for me. But, you know, the Cull issue, very close, so close, you know, based off of the art alone and the plot by Conway. I almost wanted to pick the Cull. What about you?
I'd go with Cull by a hair.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very close.
It is. It's very close. I mean, the only reason I probably would say by a little bit of a hair is because of the art, I think, in Cull being a little bit better. That's it. Because they're both very good stories, but I like the artwork and I like the cover a little bit better, too.
Yeah. And, you know, the personalities of Conan and Cull are so different. And you can see that because of the strength of the writing by Roy, and then, of course, Marie and John Severin, and now Conway as well. You can see these characters, they technically supposed to be the same, you know, a barbarian, you know, adventurer. But no, they're totally different if you look at the way they speak, the way they're presented. And I like that. I love the fact that they're so distinct.
Yep.
So, fantastic two issues. I enjoyed it. Well, I mean, listeners, that's it for another Radio Free Hyboria. Thanks for sticking with us on the Patreon. We really appreciate all the support, and we hope you enjoyed another episode. This episode is particularly of Radio Free Hyboria. We'll be back with issue 6 of Cull the Conqueror, and of course issue 6 of Conan the Barbarian in a month's time. So until then, this is Billy and me signing off. Billy, I don't know what you're going to do now, but you're probably going to tread some jeweled thrones beneath your sandaled feet. And I'm going to do what's best in life. I'm going to listen to the lamentations of some woman.
That's great.
All right. So take it easy, everybody. By Crom. We'll see you in a month's time. Cheerio.
Forgot the secret of steel and left it on the battlefield. And we who found it are just men. Not gods, not giants, just men. And the secret of steel has always carried with it a mystery. You must learn its riddle, Conan. You must learn its discipline. For no one in this world can you trust. Not men, not women, not beasts,